Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Michael Kurth and I both attended the Peabody Conservatory around the same time, although he graduated a year earlier and took a position in the New World Symphony for one season, and then promptly won a position in the bass section of the Atlanta Symphony, where he has been since 1994. Outside of the bass section, Michael has been gaining an international reputation for his fantastic compositions, has been recorded by the Atlanta Symphony, and serves as composer in residence for the chamber group I founded in 2003, the Riverside Chamber Players. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So at Peabody, you studied with Hal Robinson, who's now principal bass of the Philadelphia Orchestra and has had tremendous success with his students winning orchestra positions. But back then, you were one of his first few students to land a big job. And I don't really remember anything about Michael Kurth, the composer. I just remember Michael Kurth, the guy who's a monster on the bass. Were you composing back then?
Yeah, I was. It was obviously my focus was on getting a job. And that's one of the reasons people study with Hal is he's a very practical teacher. He teaches you, you know, important musical lessons and stuff, but also really focuses, as bass players seem to have to, on excerpts, orchestral excerpts, you know, the kind of things they ask at auditions, a lot more so than a lot of other teachers used to. And I think the bass world is coming around and really focusing, and not just the bass world, a lot of instruments are teachers are focusing on making their students more marketable in lots of ways, and not just winning auditions, but Hal is sort of a pioneer in that regard. He always focused on the excerpts because he knew that's how we earn our living. That's how we make our money day in, day out, is playing the excerpts and the orchestral stuff. We all knew the Koussevitzky Concerto and Bottesini and stuff, but nobody really wants to hear that from bass players. So,
yeah, and you were one of the first few, right? Wasn't it you and one of the other students that shared your studio won a job at the same time, right?
Well, Rick Barber won a job in Phoenix, I think.
Oh, that's right. Yep.
He and I were in the same year, but he graduated a year early to take a job out there. Now he's assistant principal bass in National Symphony in Washington, D.C., and we keep in touch. We're good friends still. There were a couple of grad students that placed jobs, also one in Phoenix and one down in Florida. Then I got New World, which was sort of a job.
Yeah, talk about New World a little bit for those who are maybe not familiar with it.
New World is a pre-professional training orchestra fellowship. It's not technically a job. It's a job. They work the hell out of you there. And it's an amazingly great orchestra with fantastic players and great leadership. They sort of filled a gap. People who had graduated conservatory with a lot of skills but weren't able to win jobs yet because there's so few orchestral, you know, professional jobs available.
Yeah.
So they sort of addressed that backlog by having a little, what they call a pre-professional training fellowship. They pay you a little stipend and they give you an apartment.
How much would you say that playing in New World helped prepare you for the big leagues and getting into Atlanta?
How much did it help me prepare? I had an extra year to work on my excerpts. Like a lot of folks go down there and they kind of get lost and party and go to the beach all the time because it's right there in Miami Beach. It's hard to avoid, but I really stuck to it and to my discipline routine and practiced a lot. Only partied when necessary.
Yeah.
It put me around a lot of other great players. I mean, Peabody was full of great players too, but their great players are spread out in many different directions. Do they want to be soloists or chamber musicians or you know, great pianists or whatever?
Right.
New World, everybody was there to learn how to get a job in an orchestra.
Did you find that most of the people in New World took it seriously if they weren't at the beach, or is it a pretty mixed bag there?
I mean, they're all serious musicians. I mean, of course, I was there 25 years ago. It's hard to compare what it is now to what it was then, I guess. They're all serious musicians, but it's really easy. Like, you know, you probably know a lot of musicians that ended up going to like a huge state school like Indiana or something.
Yeah.
And it's really easy to get lost in a huge environment like that if you're used to kind of being isolated in a practice room to begin with.
Right.
So New World was great training for me. I'm really glad I did it. I got to make some great music with some great people and make some great friends. And then I got the hell out of there.
Yeah. Seen a lot of people get hired out of New World, though.
Yeah, we have a bunch in Atlanta.
Yes, yes, we do. Well, we're going to do something a little bit different today, and we're going to play some of your music and talk about that. And I wanted to start by playing this first clip of the Mean Old Pony Tango. This is recorded by the Riverside Chamber Players, and it's available on sale at the Riverside Chamber Players site, which is riversidechamberplayers.org. And it's a CD called The Music of Michael Kurth, and it's a bunch of string quartets that he had written back when this was recorded, which was in 2013. It's been a while now. There's been more quartets that you've written since then. So let's play that, and we'll talk about it after that. So can you talk about the Mean Old Pony Tango and where this came from and the creative process that's involved in writing something like this?
One of my first commissions in Atlanta after I'd started composing a little bit was a set of string orchestra pieces for Westminster School's orchestras, string orchestras, high school. And this was a sketch that was part of that. I decided to write each movement about stories my parents had told me about when they were kids. And Mean Old Pony was a story my dad told about how some of the meaner old kids in his little tiny Wisconsin town had tied him into the saddle of a pony, apparently a mean one.
Oh, wow.
And closed the top half of the barn door and smacked the pony so it would run towards the door, and my dad got knocked off the pony.
Wow, that is a mean old pony.
I'm not sure which was meaner, the pony or the older kids, but I'm not even sure of the veracity of the story. It might be totally made up. Anyway, that was just sort of a little in-joke for me and my dad about the pony. The piece itself, I took that sketch that I had done originally for string orchestra and boiled it down to a string quartet for you guys. And actually, the first thing I did, I think first thing I did with it was turn it into a cello and bass duo. Remember playing outreaches together?
I was just about to say, I remember playing it the first time in an outreach with you.
Yeah, for cello and bass duo.
Yes.
Yeah, it was kind of fun back then.
Yes.
Our hair was less gray then.
Some of us had hair back then.
I think doing the outreach program through the Atlanta Symphony was also very helpful for me, inspiring me to be a composer, inspiring me to not just inspiring, but giving me occasion to write stuff that would get played. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I'm looking for cello and bass duos or bass and bassoon duos, and there's not really a whole lot out there. So I thought it's easier if I just write it myself than trying to dig stuff up.
Yeah, that's right. And how many different instrument arrangements have you written the Mean Old Pony Tango for?
Oh, geez. Probably at least a dozen.
Wow. What are some of the other ones?
Well, there's violin and piano, viola and cello and piano, and bass and piano. There's cello and bass duo. There's I think bass and violin duo. There's clarinet quartet. There's string quartet. There's string orchestra.
Yeah, I was a little disappointed when we recorded the quartet because you never gave me the melody again, which is what I got when we played it with bass and cello.
Oh, I sure didn't play the melody.
So how would you describe the style of music that you write, and what influenced you to write the way that you do?
I guess I'd call it words that sound pretty pejorative, but I don't really take offense at them. I think it's accessible music, mm-hmm. meaning you don't have to listen to it three or four times and take some aspirin on the way to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Whether you're a musician or not. I think it's pretty derivative, frankly. I hear different influences all over it, and other people hear it and they say, no, it sounds very you. It sounds very original. But for me, I listen to it and I can hear Rachmaninoff and Debussy and Copland and Mendelssohn and Bach and all these other influences that pervade the stuff.
Well, you're obviously also influenced by other cultures of music too, by the rhythms that you use, and you have an excellent sense of humor. You tend to put that into your music. Can you talk about how one
composes something that has a sense of humor in it, some of the tools and techniques that you use to bring that out?
No, it's a trade secret. I'm sorry.
Well, if you're not going to tell us that, you need to at least tell us where you find such fabulous pants then.
We'll get to the pants later. One of the funnier things we made our favorite violist do one time, maybe we shouldn't mention his name. Do you remember the concert when you had to play a cello solo as if you were drunk?
Yes.
And then he was disgusted by the whole drunk cellist thing and decided to show you how it was done. So he played your solo with the viola between his knees as if it were a cello.
Yep. And it sounded way better than me.
Well, you did a great job pretending you were drunk. I think I'm not sure how much preparation you'd done for that role, but
I would practice drunk. That's the best way to get that accomplished.
Good idea. The pants, they all come from Goodwill.
That's a great tip. I think people really find a lot of valuable things at Goodwill. Your pants certainly are amazing. Mm-hmm. Do you have pictures of your pants on your website?
I don't. No, I'm sorry.
Okay, we might have to do that. Okay, well, that was a good explanation, I think, of humor and how to use it, especially when you're mocking one of your fellow players. The thing that concerned me always about playing a quartet where I had to pretend I was drunk is that if people listen to the recording, they might not realize that it was intentional to sound like that.
Mm. Well, I think up to that point in the piece, you were playing pretty competently. So
I was trying.
Yeah.
So how does one juggle the life of an orchestral musician and a composer?
Well, it's really dreadfully easy right now because the orchestra's not working very much. Yeah,
that's true.
But pre-COVID, and I guess maybe this interview will be going out hopefully post-COVID.
I hope so.
As of right now, we're still sort of in the depths of it on the way out, I guess. Balance is something I don't look for. I figure balance will find me when it needs to. Mm-hmm. You know, it knows where I am. It can come looking, but I'm not going to look for it. I don't want it. I don't need it right now. I'm having a lot of fun burning the candle at both ends and in the middle at the same time. I don't sleep very much. I write a lot. I play a lot. Music is, for me, it's not just a career or a hobby. It's a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. It really pervades just about everything I do.
Have you learned to play all the instruments that you compose for then?
Oh, absolutely. No. No, actually, obviously my main instrument is the double bass. I play a tiny little bit of piano. I play some guitar, a lot of bass guitar, a little bit of cello, a little bit of viola, some percussion. I conduct a little bit. But I think the main one that I can hold up as a good example is I studied the cello for a while I was at Peabody, and I sort of stuck with it. My cello is in the shop right now. The piece we might play soon was written for solo cello, and I actually wrote it on the cello, so I could theoretically play the whole thing.
Well, let's do that. Let's play that now. We're going to play a piece. It's called "The Monster Never Tires." You just wrote it for solo cello. How long ago did you write this?
Oh, maybe 5 years ago, I guess.
Okay. Well, there's a fantastic recording, and this is what we're going to play, by Darius Skorachevsky. Darius is a cellist that was actually in my graduating class at Peabody at the same time, so all three of us went to school together. He's now the principal of the Baltimore Symphony, and if you look him up on YouTube, he has a YouTube channel filled with really, he's a fantastic cellist, and you'll hear that when we play this clip in a minute. But I'll spell his name just in case anybody out there wants to look him up. It's Darius, D-A-R-I-U-S-Z, and Skorachevsky, which is S-K-O-R-A-C-Z-E-W-S-K-I. Hopefully I got that right. Should be close enough to find him. So here is "The Monster Never Tires." Thank you.
That's a nasty piece, man. It's really hard. I've arranged it for bass and for viola too. I think maybe there might be, I don't know if there's a violin version. Like for me, that's, it's an important thing of being a composer, is making pieces malleable and portable. So you can put them in different situations. Moving a piece between cello and viola is very easy.
Yeah.
You just change the octave pretty much and make account for the, you know, how much room your fingers need on the fingerboard. You know, changing violin to viola is pretty easy also. In fact, one of the string quartets I wrote for you guys, this was on a concert. You had said, I'm going to do cello choir this concert.
Right.
And can you write us a string quartet? And I said, well, give me at least one violin and I'll do it for three cellos and one violin. And so that string quartet, I subtitled the one with all the cellos.
Uh-huh.
It worked pretty well. I think we said Tommy had to play the really high parts, I think. And,
Tommy is the newest cellist in the Atlanta Symphony, so we gave him the hardest part.
Yeah. Good string players sound good no matter what situation you put them in. If you give them music to play, they'll chew on it and they'll spit it out and it'll sound beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, it's been really fun learning how to play in the Kirthy style, as we call it when we're learning your music. There is definitely a language that you have that is unique to you. I assume you also have pop influences too. You listen to music outside of just the classical genre. Is that correct?
Yes, in fact, that is correct. I rarely listen to classical music unless I'm on stage. I think partially because being on stage with a great orchestra, it really spoils you. You don't really want to hear music on the radio or unless you have a really amazing stereo at home.
Don't you find also that when you listen to an orchestral piece, you tend to pick things apart versus just listening and immersing yourself in the experience in the same way, because we do this every day?
You know, I kind of pick everything apart that I listen to. You know, one of the tracks that my mind is always going in is, you know, harmonic analysis or rhythmic analysis, whatever I'm listening to. It's funny, my wife loves music probably more than I do, but she's a words person. She listens to the lyrics.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll tell her how much I love this song. She says, how can you love that song? The lyrics are so stupid. And I'm like, well, I wasn't even paying attention, frankly, to the lyrics.
I have the same exact thing. I never listen to the lyrics. I only listen to the music. So if there's a singer that has poetry, I'm not even really listening to that. And especially if the singer speaks or sings with great poetry, but has a terrible quality in their voice, I'm done. I can't listen past that. And but other people are motivated by what the song is about and what the singer is saying. So we definitely listen differently.
Yeah, we do. Which is also funny because I'm a writer as well. I write some songs and I write some blog stuff and just play with words a lot. So words are very important to me. And if I'm writing a piece that has lyrical content, I'm pretty ruthless when it comes to how I use the words, like in a choral piece or something.
We're going to pause for a short break. To all of you other cello Sherpas out there nurturing future generations of cellists or any other instrument, we have a new feature just for you. Many of the topics we will cover here on the Cello Sherpa podcast are worthy of further discussion, so we wanted to let you know about teaching points we'll be posting on our website after each podcast. We developed these materials with you and your students in mind. Feel free to copy them, hand them out, and use them as assignments to be completed after listening to our podcast, or just tools for raising the level of professionalism in your studio classes, rep classes, orchestra, or band programs. Please visit our website for more information and click on the Teaching Points tab. And as always, give us some feedback on what you'd like to learn more about on the Cello Sherpa podcast. And while you're at it, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on whatever platform you get your podcast from. This helps our rankings and makes it easier for others to find us. So can you tell us some of the popular groups that have influenced you?
Sure. Very influenced by Tom Waits.
Mm-hmm.
He's not as well known as he should be. He's an amazing singer-songwriter with a really real melodic gift and also a voice that sounds like he's gargling with gravel.
My favorite.
And another one you probably hate is Björk, or Björk, as I should probably call her, pronounced properly in Icelandic. She's a gifted songwriter, an amazing melodist with a voice that sounds like she's having a seizure while choking on a goat or something. It's kind of a quality it's an acquired taste, I think.
Yeah.
I love Tool. They're sort of a progressive metal band, pretty well known by now, but love, you know, music of the 70s. I love the music of Ambrosia and Lionel Richie and the Commodores and Earth, Wind, and Fire and stuff like that. I love 80s music,
uh-huh.
90s music. I enjoy a lot of music.
Yeah, that's great.
You're just as likely to find me listening to Hank Williams as Brahms.
Yeah. Who would you say then are your classical composer influences?
Bach, you know, because you can't help but be influenced by Bach. And anybody can write music that analytically perfect with music that beautiful. It's just a marriage made in heaven. Not that I write like him, but it's influential in ways that are maybe subconscious more than anything. Unless I'm trying to emulate him, which I've done before too. But love Brahms. I mean, when I say composers that influence me, I'm not sure if it's as much influence as just composers who have taught me things.
Yeah.
I love Mendelssohn. He's very underrated.
I agree.
His melodies are just, you know, the most catchy, pop, hooky things that, you know, that Europe could come up with in that century, I think.
I'd love to play much more Mendelssohn. I agree with that.
Rachmaninoff, also underrated. Or not underrated, but underestimated. I think people think of him too much as like sort of like romantic film music or something, but I think it's very well constructed stuff.
Yeah, beautiful melodies.
Just ravishingly beautiful melodies. Tchaikovsky also, I mean, also kind of, he's not really in favor among the ivory tower types, but his music is just so juicy. You know, it's just deliciously thick and meaningful.
Yeah. So what advice would you give to young instrumentalists who are also interested in composing?
I would say write for your instrument, primarily because you know your instrument. Mm-hmm. And you play your instrument, you'll give yourself a chance to be heard as a composer as well as a performer. Because, you know, you're playing a recital, throw something of your own on there. You know, composers, sort of like, you know, viruses exist to replicate, you know. if they can't, they die, and they don't care. All they want to do is reproduce. All composers want to do is get heard. Mm-hmm. Why it's, you know, that's a question for each individual composer. I don't know why I want to be heard. I want to be heard because I think I have stuff to say that might resonate with people.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't, then sorry. But, you know, if it does, then great. Because if I, you know, brought a smile to somebody's face or made somebody tap their foot, that's, my job is done there, you know. Anyway, so write for your instrument because it's a great chance to write something that's quality and great chance to be heard because you can play it yourself. Number two, take every opportunity to write for somebody. Anybody who asks you to write anything, if you get paid in pizza, that's fine. Do an arrangement for an instrument you've never learned about before, just because somebody wants you to or asks you to because they think you're their friend and they can get it from you for free. That's fine. Do it for free and keep doing it for free. And don't be afraid to suck. You're going to make a lot of mistakes. You're going to erase a lot of stuff, and that's fine. You got to get through the bad stuff before you can get to anything good. I've written a ton of stuff that's awful. Hopefully not so much anymore. I'm working on a piece right now. It's a concerto for bass. It's about time I wrote one, I guess. 2-3 weeks ago, I thought the piece was finished, and now I'm revisiting it. No, it's not done yet. This part sucks, and that part sucks. I need to X this out and revise this part and make this part better and harder and whatever, you know. It's a process. You have to really be willing to question yourself every step of the way and be willing to write bad stuff so you can get to the good stuff.
Mm-hmm. How did you learn how to write for all the instruments in the orchestra?
I play with the best instrumentalists in the world. I mean, they're on stage with me every day. So I listen, I hear, I talk to them. I know what they like. I know what they think sounds good on their instrument. I know what they think sounds awful on their instrument. I know what they don't want to do.
Yeah.
I know where to put the page turns.
I know we've had, I know we've had that experience too with reading down quartets of yours. And I even made you rewrite one of my parts once because I couldn't tackle the rhythm that you had written it in the meter that you had.
It's important. I mean, I want to write something like, you have to be aware that the vision that's in your head or what not vision, you know, the sense of what the piece sounds like that's in your head, maybe it's right, but maybe it's not as right as what the players help you write. Uh-huh. Like when I work with you guys, we'll get to a point. You'll ask somebody in the quartet will ask me, what do you think this should be like here? Do you think, you know, should I slide this or should I, you know, what about, can I slur this across the bar line? I'm like, you're the one who has to perform it. If you don't believe in what you're doing, you're invested in it as performers. So I need to give you enough trust and grace to make the decisions you want to make with it.
Yeah.
Cause if it resonates with me and it skips over you guys and you guys don't pick up the resonance of it, it's impossible to get that resonance to the audience either. You know, it has to resonate with you first as the performers.
Yeah. It won't be convincing otherwise to the audience. That's true.
Exactly. I mean, you can sell it. You could sell it, but it kind of seems like they're buying something used then at that point.
Yeah. And I do remember early on when we first started doing your quartet compositions that there weren't a lot of dynamics in there. Mm. And I came back to you and said, please give us more dynamics so that at least then you have a starting point to work
yeah,
from. So
yeah.
Feedback like that, I guess, helps you figure out how to write for certain people and how to
yeah.
encompass all the things that need to be on the page.
Yeah, and I guess too much of my time is spent with Bach because he doesn't put in any dynamics either. Yeah,
that's true. Leave it open to interpretation so that everybody can have their own version of how to play it.
Well, I think that's valid. I don't think there should be a textbook seminal version of anything that I write. If it sounds like that all the time, then it's done evolving. It's not alive anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's like language. If you're not creating any new words or any new concepts or any new uses for anything, no colloquialisms, then the language is dead at that point.
Yeah, that's interesting. I would have thought that as a composer, you would want to have everything exactly the way you want it on the page so the musicians understand how to get your vision across.
Well, no, I think it's shared vision. I mean, some composers, you know, like Mahler was like that, like Brahms too, a little bit. They could just notate the life out of their pieces, I think, in some cases. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, that makes it very easy to play because you know exactly what to do all the time. But on the other hand, it takes a lot of the agency out of your own hands, and it absolves you of responsibility for making music out of it.
Yeah.
I think. And I mean, fortunately for Brahms and for Mahler, their music is so captivating, you're drawn up into it anyway, usually.
Mm-hmm.
You collaborate in the music making. But I think music making is such a collaborative process, not just the composer and the performers, but the audience too. Like if they're not involved in it, if they're not invested in it, I mean, they paid their money for their ticket and they're invested in wanting to have a great time or wanting to learn or grow or find something beautiful or cry or break their hearts or something. You have to meet them there. You know, you have to make them part of the whole process.
Yes, which you actually have done in some of your pieces by bringing the audience in to sing.
Oh, yeah, that was fun. I remember that one.
Which reminds me, didn't you talk about doing that on your symphony piece and Robert Spano advised you that if you did that,
he
wouldn't get played?
Well, I think as a conductor who has to guest conduct a lot of places, he felt like it would be asking too much of an orchestra that he wasn't really intimately familiar with to start singing for him.
Yeah.
You know, so it would be a little bit self-consciously embarrassing to have to come in there and say, now you're going to sing. And they'd be like, nah.
Right. No. And which piece was that? Remind me.
That I wrote for you guys?
Yeah, that we ended up singing at the end.
That one was the fifth and final movement of the second sextet. That was Because They Wave Back.
Oh, that's right. Actually, we have that on CD too. We have Because They Wave Back on a CD called I've Been to the Ocean, which has a piece on it.
Mm-hmm.
That my father wrote. When he first submitted that piece to us, one of the movements, I believe, was in 6 sharps. And I told him he needed to rewrite that one also.
Yeah,
fits nicely on the piano, not so much
exactly.
In a string quartet.
Exactly, yeah. The recording we used for the CD of the Because They Wave Back, it was a live recording, right? Because we couldn't do that in the studio.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. We recorded it at Eddie's Attic, actually, in Decatur, Georgia.
That was fun. That was a fun concert.
That was really fun. And that CD is also available for sale on the Riverside Chamber Players site.
How about that?
Where can people find other music of yours for sale? I assume it's on Amazon. A lot of it is on digital tracks on Amazon. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, there's the Symphony CD was the other big release. That was most of my symphonic stuff. There was an overture called May Cause Dizziness. And there was a 3-movement work called Everything Lasts Forever. There's a 4-movement work called 1,000 Words. And then there was like this 9-movement work for chamber chorus and mezzo soprano and orchestra or small orchestra called Miserere.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, you could probably just search for any of those on YouTube. You could find those tracks.
Yeah.
The CD itself is called Everything Lasts Forever. Of course, you can buy the CD through the Symphony Store or through Amazon or whatever CD platform you want to find it on, I guess.
Yeah.
I say CD, I mean,
these days.
Because I'm old. I think. CDs are, I mean, you can't even get a computer or a car with a CD player anymore.
That's true. I think the only place you can put a CD these days is into a Blu-ray player if people are still using those. But I am actually holding 2 physical CDs at this point that don't sell quite like they used to when it comes to digital tracks.
No, but if anybody who's listening now wants to buy one of those physical CDs, I'll be glad to autograph it for you.
Yeah, I think that's great. So what else would you like to share with our audience that we've missed today?
You can hit my website is kurthmusic.com, kurthmusic.com. There's a video of that because they wave back piece. It's posted on there,
which
is not the same performance as the one that's on the CD. So if you're a completist and you want to have everything, I guess you can have them both. I mean, there's not really any premieres coming up because we're in the middle of COVID.
Any other places on social media where people can look you up?
There's Michael Kurth Composer on Facebook, but honestly, I don't maintain that page so as often as I should.
Uh-huh.
If there's some great news, I'll put it up there. But yeah, you can find me there.
Okay.
Or you can come to Atlanta. Come visit. Buy me a bourbon.
Well, we're going to do something a little bit different again, and we're going to play The Boogie Alarm, which is also on this CD, Michael Kurth String Quartets, and we're going to play that before we finish today. But before we do that, I want to thank you so much for coming on the Cello Sherpa podcast today.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. Be sure and catch our next episode where we interview Noah Bendix Bagley, concertmaster of the Berlin Philharmonic. We're here to serve you, so if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like us to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com, or tweet them at us, @thecellosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Be sure and subscribe to the Cello Sherpa podcast so you'll be notified when our next episode posts. Today's episode was produced, recorded, and edited by me, Joel Dallow.